to Cultural Fugazi, an optimistic take on the culture of the end times. I'm going to be your host, Justice, joined always by my co-host, Chris.
Hello.
Today I messed up.
Just all cards on the table,
yeah,
from the get-go.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this. We were going to do February as a labor of love. And we said we're going to watch some movies, we're going to pair those with some books. And then Chris and I both got really busy and didn't have time to do any of the book part. So we just watched a couple movies and we were trying to find out what movies to really watch that might have a compelling narrative to do with labor. So Chris picked Flashdance, which, hey, there's a conversation about labor and some stuff we can do with the movie Flashdance. There's a lot more we're going to talk about with Flashdance. And I was thinking about Western PA. Flashdance takes place in Pittsburgh. And I was kind of thinking of you know, movies that take place in similar areas and regions. So I picked Zach and Miri Make a Porno, which doesn't have as much to say about labor. It is...
From the description, you would assume...
It is also a Kevin Smith movie, right? There's something to the middle class Americana that Kevin Smith touches on. This movie doesn't do any of those really at all or well. And because it was also the weekend of Groundhog's Day, we watched Groundhog Day, which doesn't also really have a lot to say about labor.
There's some little bits in there. I think... We can say that all three of these movies have a romance plot in them.
Yep, they all three have a romance plot, for better or for worse. For, I think, all of them, it's worse.
Yeah.
Every single one is bad.
Yeah.
But they all do take place in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Most importantly, the greater Pittsburgh area. Punxsutawney is not Pittsburgh.
But, I mean, they're but, coming from
but
Pittsburgh.
But they're coming from Pittsburgh. Yeah, yada, yada, yada. So, you know, Pennsylvania. There is zero representation of Pennsylvania Dutch, which is disappointing to me. but these are all kind of PA, Steel City, USA, small town, Americana movies. And that's kind of the thesis is... I wrote this down because we had to make something up after we watched it. And went, oh, this is not really that much about labor. The thing that all of these movies do is they are pop media depictions of Western Pennsylvania, and they kind of reflect, again, for better or for worse, the small town working city snapshots at the time. So Flashdance is 1984, 82?
83.
Exactly in between the two.
Yeah.
and Zach and Miri is 2008, which... is the least and most 2008 movie that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk a little bit about Groundhog's Day, which was also
93.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So we got an 80s, 90s, and 2000s.
Yeah.
For all of that stuff. And kind of just how they all portray this specific type of representation of Pennsylvania pre-Rust Belt.
Yeah.
Zach and Miri is, I think, the closest to Rust Belt.
Yeah, I would say that Zach and Miri does land on Rust Belt. We have some bits in there where you can see, like, the decay is clear. There are, like, two or three things that the movie actually, like, does to comment on labor and the situation in Pennsylvania where you get that.
Yeah.
And we will definitely talk about those things.
Because that's it. that's really all there is in there for besides the rest of it, which we will mostly have to condemn, I think. Just like the building in the movie that gets destroyed for condos.
That's one of the things.
We will have to condemn most of Zach and Miri to be destroyed. But we'll talk about kind of what it has in there and what's good in it as we go on. But first, we're going to kick things off with Groundhog Day because it's the most relevant and recent thing that's in the movie. This year, I found out that Cleveland has a cat that we make eat a pierogi.
Good work, Cleveland.
Yeah.
That's
Cleveland remains superior to most other cities
and
for
keeps
just
being the most Cleveland. I love that, like, I've been alive for a few decades now, for a little bit, and Cleveland just keeps Clevelanding.
Yeah, it's the most Cleveland it has ever been.
Yes.
But grab your icy lights and your Yinglings, Yinzers, because we're going on a journey. So Groundhog Day is Punxsutawney, PA. We got Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog. Bill Murray plays another character named Phil, who is a weatherman for Channel 9 Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Which I can't remember if that's a real Pittsburgh affiliate or not. I'm assuming it is. I'd have to go back. I'd have to think really hard.
I don't know offhand either.
Yeah. I grew up closer to Youngstown and Boardman, Ohio. So like this area, this tri-state area. Zach and Miri actually make references to like Monroeville and some of the places that I would go shopping as a kid. So yeah, Punxsutawney is a little bit further out there for me.
Yeah.
And I actually don't think that Groundhog's Day as a movie is really interested in what I would call like a specifically Pennsylvanian experience.
Yeah, it gets a little bit of that, like my dad is from Pittsburgh. And so I too, like, would say that it's not honing in on that kind of experience. I think there's a little bit of small town Pennsylvania that you do get. One of my college friends was from a small town, like probably closer to, actually it was closer to where the movie's set. And he seems like one of the characters from that movie.
Okay.
So like, yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Loves WrestleMania.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as far as like what Groundhog's Day has to say about labor, I think there's, and class, there's definitely some class conversation to be had with, you know, Phil comes in from Pittsburgh, which even he's too big for Pittsburgh, but he comes to this super small town. He's been there a bunch. He hates the small town Americana, Main Street USA-ness of, this version of, Punxsutawney, and, you know, doesn't like the one hotel because it's a roach nest that he calls it, and doesn't really like the diner and doesn't really like the food. And again, if this was more PA, there would be more pierogies involved.
Yeah.
But
right. Well, I do get the sense that it's like it's not super explicit, but it seems like you have a character who came from a small town and made it big as a weatherman in Pittsburgh, and is like continuing to distance himself from that small town experience. So part of the whole vibe is, no, I'm better than this. I've escaped from this. These people are below me. I am now a fancy high class person, and these are low class people.
Yeah. His producer, which is also eventually his primary love interest, mm-hmm. is kind of folksy, she's not necessarily manic pixie girl, but she's
adjacent.
Yeah, but she's
this idea will come up later on when we talk about Flashdance. But she is not a manic pixie dream girl, but she is the movie
she's
does
a variation
enough
of it
to give her like some kind of personality that's not just dreamy, star eyed, romantic, and like
yeah.
We're like right there.
Yeah.
We're in that neighborhood.
It's a fork of it.
Yes.
Right. Of like,
yes.
Hey, we added some more texture. She's not just like, ooh, but
yeah.
She's definitely, which is my favorite impression of Manic Pixie Girls. but she's definitely something, right? She wants a man.
It's a little bit more grounded than your typical Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Yeah. She's the blue collar version.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Perfect.
She just wants a man who will, you know, kids and respect her, but also knows French poetry.
Yes. So like she is interested in like settling down, whereas most Manic Pixie Dream Girls are like, let's go to Europe or whatever.
Right. But also she has a background in like French literature or something. So she's adjacent.
And also accent that like vaguely Southern?
Impossible to place.
Maybe Midwestern? Who could say?
Who could say?
Maybe California. Like,
it would make sense if she's from Parma. They're like, actually, I'm from Ohio. We're at Parma. And you'd be like, okay.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Something like that would work. But Groundhog Day is a really... I just want to touch on it a little bit because it's a little bit of that PA experience, but I think there's something to Groundhog Day to come back to for any other topic.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of other stuff going on here that's very interesting. And, like, I think it doesn't necessarily get into some of the sort of Rust Belt sensibility that I think we'd like to dig into today. But it does, I think the fact that you have this day happening over and over and over again is absolutely a reflection of alienation of labor under capitalism, where you are doing a thing that, like, hypothetically, you should have some interest in, should, like, provide some sense of accomplishment and well-being, but, like, it ends up being just for money. And clearly Phil is just in this for the money and the fame. And as it turns out, that ends up being just an endless cycle that repeats over and over and over again, because there is no way to get fulfillment from that when it's all monetary and when your labor has become solely about the money that you can extract from it.
Right. And I believe at the end of the film, they decide that they're going to move to Punxsutawney and they're going to find different jobs or do the job from there or something, because it turns out labor doesn't have to be your life.
Yes.
Which I think on a long enough timeline, right, that he goes through the same day over and over and over again. The thing that he breaks out of the cycle with is he goes through every cycle of optimism and hope and grief and everything in between, and ends, you know, the movie ends on a pretty optimistic note that, hey, you can discover the tools that you need to escape this drudgery and live a fulfilling life where you build community with the people around you. And that on a long enough timeline, there is goodness in everyone, right?
Well, and if you stop treating everything around you as an object and start treating other people as subjects that, like, have interior lives, that, like, maybe if you care about them in the same way as you care about yourself, and there's a lot of hint in the, not a lot, it's explicit text in the movie that Phil hates himself, and it's not until he starts to recognize that people in general, and that includes him, are worthwhile, that, like, oh, community, it's actually more important than money and labor. So, like, that's...
Yeah, there's something here, so it's kind of like, well, we'll touch on it, because it was the holiday, and we watched it.
It's near Pittsburgh. It's near Pittsburgh. You can have these revelations near Pittsburgh.
Yeah, someone at some, and one of these scenes, not explicitly stated, would have tried to put French fries on top of a sandwich. There's coleslaw everywhere.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
You can know it.
Yeah.
You can sense it.
I think... probably in that diner scene where he's eating all the breakfast food, there's coleslaw there.
There's coleslaw there. Yeah. I promise you. There's definitely a pierogi. Mm-hmm. I don't know in Groundhog Day if we see any Iron City beers.
I don't think that
I don't think we do.
No. We see Miller. We do see, there is a Yingling sign on the bar that goes to.
Makes sense.
But I think that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Where... in the 80s and the 2000s, we see a ton of Iron City.
Yeah.
So just a thing to be aware of. Like, it's obviously not it's the greater Pittsburgh area, not Pittsburgh.
Yes.
So, sense. So with that all being said, we're going to move right along into Zach and Miri Make a Porno. Mostly because I think we're going to have the most to chew on with Flashdance and what it actually says about labor. Mm-hmm. And I think the nicest thing we'll have to say about Zach and Miri is that it's a movie.
I had a hunch you were going to say that.
I was going to send you a parody of the text message you sent me with Bamboozled. As I was watching that was going to be like, hey, there's some challenging content in here. Because there's just some shit in here that does not fly in 2024. There's a lot of punching down on the gay and queer community.
Yeah. And disabled folks.
Yeah. There's a lot of language that even in 2008 was not really in use that much anymore. Mm-hmm. We were kind of stepping away from that way of communicating to use, you know, calling someone queer or various other terms for that as insults. The movie punches down on characters specifically that are gay. Mm-hmm. You know, Justin Long and Brandon Routh, Superman, or CW's Superman, more importantly, who's, I think, a really fun person. They play a, you know, he's Brandon Ruth, whatever the fuck, plays the high school quarterback who's now gay and moved to LA and is dating a gay porn star who's played by Justin Long, mm-hmm. which if you were making that movie then or now, maybe actually hire some gay actors to do this instead of making the joke that this is that that's the joke. Like it does not work.
Well, and very much a caricature, which, I mean, all these characters are pretty one dimensional. So I suppose at least it wasn't just the gay character.
If you were going to do that, though, at least get gay people to do it. Like if, but if that's not the thing, is them being gay is the joke.
Yes.
Right. That's why it really does not work. You know, coming off of Bamboozled, where Bamboozled does, and 8 years before this, does a very compelling part of how the terms and the way people are talking in the movie is part of the movie.
Yes.
And it's there to help you understand that whenever they reference the N-word, whenever they're talking in specific situations and ways that it's used and who's using it and how it's being said is important. No part of Zach and Miri Make a Porno involves language being used in specific things to show greater Pittsburgh, except whenever the guy comes in from the coffee shop, hammered drunk, and says, Ben Roethlisberger did the football thing, which is the most Pittsburgh fucking thing in the world. More so than the Crosby jerseys, or not the Crosby jerseys, but the hockey jerseys pretty much.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Like, it's definitely a snapshot of a time and place. And as we were saying before, it does kind of show a snapshot of some Rust Belt Americana. There is some of that there. Specifically, they end up in a condemned warehouse that gets turned into condos.
Yeah. So, and this part, again, there are like two things in this movie that actually like were interesting and worthwhile to talk about. And one of them is, they rent this property from a landlord who's like, yeah, you've got like a week. It's totally cool. And they show up the second day and it's being torn down. And they got all their set stuff, their cameras, they spent thousands of dollars to get all this equipment and to set all this stuff up. And it's just being destroyed as part of this condemned building. And they go, what are you doing here? And the guy's like, oh, what do you mean? They're like, well, we rented this from this landlord. And he said, we have it for a week. And the guy's like, that landlord was bullshitting you. So I don't know what to tell you, man.
He's back in Florida.
Yeah, he moved to Florida. So, which is a great, like, that is a very, very, like, accurate portrayal of landlords that works to this day. And they're building luxury condominiums.
Yep.
So, yeah, spot on.
Greater Pittsburgh area, Monroeville.
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Yes. Yeah.
One of the things the movie does reference, to talk a little bit about the other like labor portrayals in the movie, is that the jobs that they have currently at the time that the movie is written, are not labor or is not steel industry jobs anymore, right? This movie takes place in Pittsburgh and no one's talking about working at a steel mill, which is a very like accurate reflection.
Yeah, they have low paying service industry jobs. They're working at a coffee shop as baristas.
And that is the one like 2008 snapshot that is the most 2008 thing. Hey, here's Steel City, USA. Go Steelers.
Yeah.
You know, as one man comes in. No one calls anyone a Yinzer.
Yeah.
Not a single one. In any of these movies, do I hear that Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania twang either that I expect out? I'm like, none of these movies do a good job of being in Pittsburgh.
No, we did get the one guy who says cockroach, which.
Yep. That's literally the one time.
Yeah.
This is me pointing adamantly at Chris. That's literally the one fucking time where he says the cockroach in Flashdance. And I was like, finally, someone from fucking Pittsburgh.
Right.
He would have been the one that I would have expected to have said Yinzer.
Oh, like, absolutely.
He would be the one.
Yeah.
But to get back to the Zach and Miri, the labor opportunities that they have, no one is talking about getting a better job. And is that because our characters are slackers who fuck around all the time? Or is it because the labor market in Pennsylvania and what options you have to do work. These are all supposed to be 28-year-olds which Seth Rogen playing a 28-year-old.
That movie,
even whenever he shaves his face, he does still look like a boy. But like him and Elizabeth Banks do not pull off 28 in that film because it's their 10-year high school anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And that ain't it. But the whole thing kind of just doesn't really work. There's nothing there that I would say, let's come back to this and view this now through a highbrow lens of a lowbrow comedy and mm-hmm. walk away with anything that I think stands out.
Yeah, I think that's one of the frustrating things is like that. Again, you've got like one or two things where like it starts to seem like it's gonna do something interesting and it doesn't. And you know, one of them is that condemned building piece. Like I expected there to be a bit more like building on the idea that they can't get these jobs, that this is a steel town that has no opportunities, that, you know, we get the fact that they can't pay their bills. And it seems like that was a really, really fertile ground to be able to like couch some of these conversations in. And we just never bother to actually explore any of that, which you set it up and then you just like walked away from it. And it felt like the whole movie was a lot like that. Like you set it up and you walked away from it to do one dimensional portrayals of stuff that, like, other movies do better one-dimensional portrayals that are more fun to watch. So yeah. It's like, if I'm gonna watch kind of a crappy romantic comedy, this is not going to be the one that I'm going to pick up.
No, it's not. Especially, like, you know, this is kind of labeled as, like, a rated R sex comedy, right? They have multiple porn stars are in there as porn stars. Apparently, one is from Steubenville, Ohio.
Hmm.
And that's why they got her for the movie.
Oh, interesting.
And they were like, oh, this would ground this a little bit. So, sure. sure. You know, it's okay. It's something.
Uh-huh.
And it's just not, even as far as like sex comedies go, yeah. Right? Like you can say something, you know, knowing that there's something to lowbrow comedy to like express something. There are other rated R comedies kind of pre and post this that I would recommend to people now more, definitely way more than this movie, that I think also kind of stumble on some of the same subject matter, but just deliver a better movie.
Right.
There's nothing here. There's nothing here at all. Like there's very little. They don't even set up like the jokes good.
No,
like,
they don't. They don't.
It's kind of well casted. I mean, for a Kevin Smith movie, it's kind of well casted.
Which makes some of that kind of frustrating because you know you have the talent to pull.
Then again, half of these people ended up also in Hot Tub Time Machine. You know, like, so maybe I'm expecting too much. Maybe this is me where I thought there would be something to like, hey, no, it's a movie about how the fact that people can't find jobs and they move into sex work, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
There's something there.
Yeah.
And from someone who cares about that primarily white, but not every character in this movie is white, mm-hmm. but that primarily white middle-class experience like Kevin Smith can do.
Yep. And
they build a found family that's, you know, diverse from a culture and background perspective.
Well, and this was another, like, one of the areas where, like, they start to scratch the surface of this, but they don't dig as much into it as I would have loved. You get a depiction of what essentially mutual aid looks like, where, you know, you have all of their bills have been, like, well past due to the point where everything is shut off. They have no power. They have no water. They have nothing. They have a bonfire that they are lighting in the middle of their apartment to stay warm. And like everyone's like, you know, we got kind of tired of you having to use our showers every day. So we pitched in and we paid your bills. And this is the whole found family staff of this movie that does this, which is exactly like how mutual aid works. It's, hey, you might not be able to handle this now, but we know that like if you could do this, you would have our back. And so we're going to have your back because we're a community and we look after each other. And like it starts to do that. And then we go back to the kind of bad, funny parts of the movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's... I will say that it's surprising to me that out of all of the actors and actresses in the movie, that I actually think that Jay is the funniest. in the movie, playing very much not a Jay style character. Like, he's actually funny in a movie that has comedians that I think are better than him. But his whole thing is he's just a fucking, he's a normal creep.
Yes. And plays it totally deadpan and straight and just like commits to the bit.
They, you know, they're talking about who's going to film sex scenes with who. And he's like, oh, I don't want to have to fuck a guy, but I'll fuck a guy. Like, whatever. I'll do it.
Yeah.
You know, where Seth Rogen's character comes off as just a fucking creep.
Yes.
At the beginning of the film, it does not help that on the this is a Weinstein production. The first, and then you have a character, you know, trying to solicit sex from every female character he encounters.
The whole, unfortunately, the content of this movie suffers very greatly from the executive producers involved.
It's not a great, 2024 is not the time to go watch Zach and Miri make a porno.
No.
It's not. And I'm happy we could do that for you. Listeners at home, we suffered so you don't have to. Don't pick it up. I don't even know. Chris, I stole this off the internet.
Yes.
I couldn't even find it in 1080p. No one is uploading high quality rips.
I can't imagine
of Zach and
Miri
make a porno. I don't even know if there is one. Like, is there a Blu-ray of this somewhere? I have to assume
not. I don't know.
So, I think that's anything to add.
I mean, I will. The one other thing that I will say, you mentioned we talked a little bit before recording about Kevin Smith and his other works, and you mentioned you haven't seen Clerks.
Yeah,
and you know, I think one of the things I have seen Clerks. It's been a while.
I actually think to interrupt you, obviously, as I've done.
Yeah, of course.
I think I've seen more of the Clerks cartoon than I have Clerks.
Okay, well, sure. I mean, that gives you a general sense.
Yeah,
but I think one of the things that I think really stands out and like is a stark division between those two is that Clerks has like very fully formed characters. And so even though some of the jokes are as childish and like today you might look back at them and go, well, we wouldn't use that language. They still work because they're grounded in the characters in a way that this movie doesn't manage to do. And I think one of the things that we unfortunately missed out on because of that is you could have really made Pittsburgh more of a character in this movie if you had given those characters some space to grow and to like actually be able to be represented as human beings and not just as caricatures. So I think this movie could have given us more Pittsburgh, which would have probably given us more to chew on as far as what does this have to say about like the labor, and what does this have to say about the fact that these folks can't pay their bills and can't get a job? But we don't get to have those conversations because those characters don't give us enough to hang off of.
It's funny because the movie takes place in Monroeville, which is about as Pittsburgh as Parma is Pittsburgh. But yes, correct.
Yeah,
I mean, they do, like, they're close enough that people are coming home from the bar or coming home from the game that they stop at the coffee shop or whatever.
Right.
But you're driving through there on your way into town.
Right.
He also references multiple times a movie that is, I think, better with one-dimensional characters and an essay on commercialism, which is Dawn of the Dead, which was filmed in the Monroeville Mall, which he shoots a scene really quick in the Monroeville Mall, and the hockey team is called the Monroeville Zombies, and they're obviously paying tribute to Dawn of the Dead, and so, like, it's in there.
Yeah.
Yep. There's something, like, Kevin Smith knows something that, hey, maybe there's something here that's important, and we could tie this to Pittsburgh and this kind of area of Pennsylvania and say something with it. But instead he does a really bad, not a really bad, he just does a bad comedy.
Yeah.
It's not abysmal.
No.
It's just not funny.
Yes. I think that's part of it's also not, like, bad enough to be interesting in that respect. It's just,
it's not even a good, like, the romance plot isn't great either. Like, the whole reason they do the sex scene, and then it's like, because we're doing a thing where we have to have sex with other people, and then they just communicate poorly, but not even really communicate. They just fail.
Yeah, it's, they do the romantic comedy plot that I hate the most, and they do it the worst I've ever seen it done. Yeah,
it's just not, it's not good. And then it's also that 2008 like cringe comedy also that just
All of these movies have interesting perspectives on how love and romance works. And look, romantic comedies are often going to have problematic depictions of love. But oh boy, this one.
It's, yeah. It's not even, I don't even know if I would call it problematic, because it would require people. And there's no people in the movie. They're just not, they're not people. So like, is it a problem if they're not people? There's so many other things that it does do where it tries to make any sort of statement to anything, and it's not great. So that's Zach and Mary Make a Porn. Sorry. We kind of, like I said, I picked a dud, and there's not much to say about it.
Yeah.
So with that, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with our next movie. I'll be right back.
Talk about Flashdance, where Pittsburgh is way more of a character in this movie than any of the other movies that we've talked about.
Absolutely. There is a little bit of that Steel City, Working City dynamic that Flashdance specifically wants to play with, that is also very Cleveland, very Pittsburgh.
Yes.
That working class, blue collar with like the arts scene and the glamour of ballet and ice skating and all that stuff, which is what these industrial urban centers are all about.
Yeah. Well, and the movie very specifically starts us off with a scene. You see the city, like it's our main character. She is on a bike petting a cat, which, good work, movie.
Yep.
You're already
right
playing.
Away, endearing.
But then we immediately go into scenes at the steel mill. And like, very much like, yeah, hey, we're in Pittsburgh. This is a steel
town.
Also,
1,000 bridges.
Oh,
yeah. First thing you see, 1,000 bridges. Yeah, that's how you know you're in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, absolutely.
The fact that none of them were backed up is how you start to realize that you've entered a fantasy version of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, this is a fairy tale Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. It's not.
Yeah.
Totally real Pitts, but it's closer to real Pittsburgh than what we've seen so far. So yeah, like already you've got your character, who we are immediately told this is she's a blue collar worker. She's hanging out, and we don't even like, we see her initially on the bike, but then we see a bunch of steel workers like welding stuff, hammering stuff. Yeah, that initial scene almost feels a little bit like sci-fi with how much metal and like molten. The movie is setting a scene.
Mm-hmm. And it does it really effectively. Like, if you've ever been in a... This is the thing. I can't tell... They're not in a mill, or at least they're not in a mill as I know a mill to
right.
be, which there would be more people trying not to fall asleep. and there would be more cranes. But they're definitely doing something either in construction or something like that. We get that our primary character is a welder. At 18 years old, which, Chris, I hate to tell you this, I don't think that's really possible.
Wait, what? What do you mean?
I believe she would be an apprentice. Welding is a union job. Like, there's ways to get into the industry and like, and how you get that job and how you work through all that stuff. And I don't think that she would be necessarily doing what she's doing in the movie.
You know, I immediately, when they first say her age, because there's a point where they, like, you don't know exactly how old she is until someone specifically says she's 18. And I wrote down, wait, she's 18? Question mark, question mark, question mark. How long has she been working? Question mark, question mark, question mark. This doesn't seem possible.
Now, with the scenes that we do see her, she is sometimes working by herself. But that maybe that means that she could still be an apprentice. We don't know.
True.
But yeah, I don't think that's how that works.
Yeah. No, I imagine that it takes more than just 1 year. Although, hey, labor laws were slightly different in the 80s. I don't think they were that different.
I don't think so.
Yeah. I think that is another area where you're like, oh, we are in a fairy tale. And I mentioned, to me, this seems very much like she has to be 18 for the ballet piece to work. Because if you get too much older than 18, now you are too old to be a ballerina.
Right.
Frankly, at 18, you're probably usually, technically too old.
Yeah, you're usually
so, like, I think the movie is hedging a bit there. But, yeah. Playing fast and loose. So.
Yeah. And also the romance plot doesn't work if she's any younger.
It's questionable.
It's questionable
as it is.
Yeah. Oh boy. Flashdance. We were just talking about this as we took a break and grabbed some bourbon. There's enough about Flashdance that we can actually talk about, you know, while watching Flashdance, I was joking and making fun about it. You know, like it's fun to watch even if it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
Where Zach and Mary is not good to like, you're not watching that to make fun of it either. It's just not good. But this movie definitely has a style to it. It has a fucking awesome soundtrack.
Oh my God. Good work, Giorgio Moroder, which unsurprising. Like,
unsurprising. I mean, you have, 2 songs nominated.
Yep.
Off the movie soundtrack. What is it? Flashdance. The main song is Flashdance /
Yeah. More Than a Feeling.
More Than a Feeling.
Yeah.
And then you have Maniac.
Absolutely.
Which Flashdance / More Than a Feeling is the song that won. Mm-hmm. Where I think about Maniac all day, every day, and I think that's the song that should have won.
I mean, that song is an iconic song that will live with us in perpetuity.
Right. Now that I've said Maniac, I'm thinking about Maniac.
Yeah.
And I will be thinking about Maniac until I will have to force myself to listen to something else.
Even while you were talking about More Than a Feeling, my brain was just playing Maniac.
Yep. Ah, such a good soundtrack. And like the other songs on that soundtrack are good.
Yeah.
Like, hey, there's a reason that movie, even the way, like, was not liked by critics.
Mm-hmm.
I think you said you had read the Roger Ebert review.
Ebert. Not a fan. Not at all a fan.
But the soundtrack was really well received, very popular. It bangs.
Absolutely.
But also half the movie's a music video.
Yes.
So like it better.
Yes.
But yeah, Maniac. Movie gave us Maniac. Worth it. Like watch like no matter what how challenging the rest of the content is of the movie. The piece of art as it exists has produced Maniac, therefore I forgive it its faults.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of places where this movie like absolutely drops the ball and some places where like it makes egregious mistakes, but it's an entertaining movie.
Yeah.
And I mentioned this to Justice earlier, so I have seen this movie a few times before, although I haven't seen it in a long time because my parents showed it to my sisters and I very young, and now seeing it again for the first time in many, many decades, I'm like, oh, perhaps that was not appropriate to show children as young as my sisters and I were. But I also think there's a fascinating way in which some of the content is very clearly not for kids, but like a lot of that movie works to show to kids because it is one dimension. It's a fairy tale.
Yeah. It's also a fairy tale about a biracial black woman who works an industrial job who eventually ends up a ballerina by the end of the movie.
Yeah.
I could understand why you would think to show that to, you know, black or biracial group of girls, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Makes sense to me.
Absolutely.
You know, like there's something there to be like, no, you can do anything you want.
Yes.
You know, there's something to that. Now, does she get that through hard work and dedication? No.
Mm-hmm.
She fucks an older man.
Which,
but also,
I mean, that I don't think was necessarily intentional, but that is a surprisingly good depiction of how things do work in the real world.
Totally. Yeah, totally.
Which,
but it's funny in the fairy tale. It's like, no, you gotta fuck the prince and that's how you get the ballerina.
Which
job.
Again, not good that you've got this 38-year-old dude and this 18-year-old together. That's not good. That there should be commentary about that we as
one of the, even one of the characters, the comedian played by a Pesci, right? makes fun of the guy for being old.
Yes.
So like even the characters know in the movie that it's weird. He said, yeah. "Oh yeah, like talking about busting noses or because he gets his nose punched in."
It's like, "Oh, they did that a lot in the 50s, didn't they?"
Yeah, and he's like, "No, it was more like the 60s." So like they both know that he's an older man in this situation, and it's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
That's the most commentary we get on it.
Yes.
Which, if you watch that movie now, I had to try to do the math to be like, okay, when does this movie take place? And technically, so that makes this guy how old?
Yeah.
Because I don't think they ever specifically say his age.
No. The internet will tell you it's 38.
Yeah.
Which, like,
if you crunch the numbers, yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
So really quick, get some of the paperwork out of the way. This movie was released in...
So this is an 83 movie directed by Adrian Lin. And we have Alex, our main character, played by Jennifer Beals.
Yep. And those are the only names. Jessica Beals is kind of the only name I think you need to really take out of that, right?
Yeah. Also interesting to know, Jerry Bruckheimer. I think this was like one of... might have even been his first big hit that then led to... Which like... has nothing to do with labor, but fascinating to realize like this is the thing that then spawned the like Jerry Bruckheimer has done so much pop culture stuff now. That's
got it.
Yeah.
Huh.
So yeah. Right.
Weird.
Right.
There's, like I said, there's something to, I think it's fairy tale, like as your, Cinderella story, or not even really a Cinderella story. I don't know which fairy tale this would be. A direct allegory of, but yeah, a young girl wants to be a dancer. So at night she is an exotic dancer, but not a stripper.
Yeah.
Not a stripper. She just does. This is one of the things that I don't think that I have enough knowledge about to talk about like this movie in relationship to like burlesque.
Yes.
And drag shows
is much more the vibe that, the show that they're putting on is definitely more of your burlesque style show.
Yep.
So very much supposed to be focused on the costuming, the dancing, the music.
Yep.
And the movie, I didn't remember this either. The movie does have a bit of a moral bug up its ass a bit. And you get that from the very beginning because Alex goes to confession and tells a priest about her sins and their... The sins initially are all very like, oh, this is like a sweet, innocent young girl.
I lied and I did this.
And then you get a character who like is definitely doing things that are far less morally gray than those things. Like things that if you went to say, hey, priest, I am dancing with half of my clothing off in this club. And also I'm having sex with this 38-year-old man. And also... at a restaurant, I'm just going to put my foot in his crotch.
That's honestly the restaurant scene where she's on the date with him.
Yes.
And in the confession scene, right? And this is the thing that I took away from the confession scene initially, where she tells the priest, I've been thinking about sex a lot.
Yes.
Right? And she's been thinking about sex a lot. Mm-hmm. Because by the time she goes out to dinner with her 38-year-old boyfriend, we don't understand that she's virtually wearing nothing.
Yeah.
While trying to fuck a lobster with her mouth. She's like slurping down these lobster bits, which is not a great way to, you don't eat meat, but it's not how I would eat lobster. It is a buttery food.
Sure.
So you may want to like dunk it, obviously. Get a good amount of butter on there.
Okay.
And like I could understand how you might think some slurping is involved.
Okay.
But it's not how I think you would eat lobster. Good
to know.
Yeah. If you're
good
gonna
for that like, added yeah, context. Yeah, great.
Spaghetti works way better for that. Like if you're gonna do like something like that or like ice cream or something or like a banana, I don't know.
Mm.
But yeah, to do it with lobster. And then the guy's ex-wife comes in and kind of like is, you know, implying that she's a young whore or whatever. And then she takes off the jacket that she has on so that we find out that she's virtually wearing nothing underneath anything. It's just like, okay, so she's been thinking about sex a lot.
Yes.
But she's not a stripper.
Yes. This is definitely one of the areas that I find particularly frustrating about this movie. It very clearly has that kind of like, well, burlesque is art, but stripping is trash.
That's crime.
Yeah, almost. And like it does some like really weird Madonna whore stuff with Alex in a way that is frustrating because like it doesn't make sense for her character doesn't get to like have a consistent personality. Because the movie wants her to have this scene where, look at how intense and in your face she is. It's like, right. Yeah, but at the beginning of the movie, like that character wouldn't do this.
Right. She's a part of the girls in the back, and they're talking about their relationships and mm-hmm. kind of where they are. And she's an optimist, right? Mm-hmm. He'll call you back. Is her friend's like, he hasn't called yet, and I don't know if he's gonna call me. And she's like, oh, he'll call you back. And then she gets sassy and mean.
Yeah.
And horny and whatever. And like, so and we don't get that developed, right? That's not like a journey that she goes on where she's like, I've always been, unless we missed it in dance, right? Yeah. unless you and I misinterpreted some of the dance scenes.
No, we didn't. Trust me.
I couldn't watch the half of the fucking one because it was just a goddamn seizure warning. Like, yeah, God,
yeah,
Christ.
Yeah.
So maybe that was whenever she found out she was horny. I don't know.
Well, no. So I think to bring this back to something we talked about earlier, she is very clearly a proto-manic pixie dream girl. Like,
yeah.
This is very much like, hey, this is the template that we will build the manic pixie dream girl on when we eventually get its final form in the 90s and the 2000s.
Yeah. We had to get Flashdance before we could get Eternal Sunshine.
We did.
So,
which, you know what? Okay. Great movie. I love that movie. Right. It does a really nice job of deconstructing the manic pixie stereotype.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But in this case, I think part of what is incredibly frustrating is you have a movie that portrays this, hey, she's doing blue collar work to help pay the bills. And then she's doing dancing, which is her passion. And clearly she can't make enough money just doing that. So she's got to do the welding. But then the movie looks down on people that are stripping and makes it seem like that is morally repugnant, despite the fact that you are going to have a lot of people who are doing that for very similar motivations and reasons to why she's doing what she's doing.
And also the storyline they build around the stripping part, right?
Yes.
It's her friend who's the ice skater.
Yep.
It turns out that her family supports her. She has a supportive family.
Mm-hmm.
She's not able to achieve her dreams. She falls down twice in the competition that she's doing, and she's kind of going to age out of dancing or ice skating. So with the aging out of ice skating part, her boyfriend asks her, well, can't she just try again? And she's like, no, this is kind of it.
Yeah.
If she's not good, like if she doesn't make it now, she's not going to make it, which is a very true thing.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of, I don't know if we ever get the motivation of like why that's the case. Other than age.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is very much a, hey, ice skating, just like ballet. Like you are too old way sooner than you would expect. And I think that's the kind of thing where they don't say that she's like trying out for the Olympics or something like that, but like it's probably something along those lines where
that's what I was assuming.
Yeah. And you've got your shot here and literally you are going to be too old.
Right.
2 years from now when you,
if you're not making it now, you will, no one's ever going to hear of you ever again.
Yes.
And that makes sense, but it could have been more explicit. I don't like, that's kind of the thing. For how much the movie leads you by the nose everywhere, that could have been more explicit. But then she is one of the burlesque dancers at the club.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, she's dating the cook at the club who is
that they're dating. They're, like, she clearly likes him. Like,
they eventually do make it explicit that they are, and like, so he moves to LA to kind of go pursue being a comedian because he does one good, he does literally one good open mic set. And he's like, I'm moving to LA. Fuck this.
Yeah.
Which
is, hey, remember when Polish jokes used to be a thing? Because this movie remembers.
Oh, man. Oh, geez. The delivery of the absolute shit is great because also like the guy fails with a lot of this stuff and then eventually like learns how to be a comedian immediately.
Yeah, he makes the cockroach joke then we get the cook saying cockroach, which finally.
Yes.
Yeah.
To bring it actually into Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Also, minute of starting to movie to first icy light is very small.
Yeah.
It's pretty quick. Yep. We see a lot of icy or Iron City beer on an icy light. Just a regular Iron City.
Yes.
Pretty quick.
Yep.
Pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
With some signage in the restaurant in the back.
Yeah, we are in that bar. So you get the opening montage of the steelwork, and then she bikes to the bar, and boom, there you go. We're in.
There's an Iron City.
Yeah.
So the young girl who's doing the ice skating, she fails at the ice skating thing. Her boyfriend, who's the comedian, moves to L.A. And then the other guy who runs the strip club comes in.
Zanzibar.
Yeah, the Zanzibar. Tips her really well. Which she doesn't know how to take, which one, in a real life situation, she would go, oh yeah, money, sure, and just move on. Mm-hmm. But she's like, oh, I don't know how to accept all this money. And then this turns into them having a relationship.
Yeah, you get at the very beginning of the movie, Alex is walking with Jeannie, the ice skater. Like, they're walking down the street, and this owner tries to, like, convince them both, like, you should be working for me at my strip club, like, you will make so much money if you do. And like, at that point, because Jeannie's soul hasn't been broken by failing at the ice skating, like, she's like, ha 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 ha, and Alex is like, you're an ass, like, right. we want nothing to do with you, and they write him off, and they make it very clear that, like, this guy's kind of sleazy and we don't want anything to do with him.
Well, she changes her mind, apparently, after her brain is, you know, her hopes and dreams are destroyed. She goes to work at Zanzibar and does the stripping thing. And there's more how that works in real life. Also usually involves these club owners giving them cocaine and heroin or now fentanyl. So like, there's more to that story than just like nowadays, like, well, or even most situations.
Yeah, but I think that that's part of what's frustrating to me is that there are multiple ways to get involved in that work. And some of those ways are coercive and bad.
Yeah.
But
and that's what the movie's implying. The movie's implying the coercive and bad part.
Yes. And I think the thing that I did not care for is that the movie conflates the sex work with that and says, oh, this is just what you get.
Both of these things are the same thing.
Yes, yes.
Where that's not true, but it implies that, you know, shady club owner gets this girl involved. Mm-hmm. Hey, we know that that's probably the coercive route.
Yes.
But we don't get that distinction between the coercive route and like the way that might happen for someone who does it for various different reasons or whatever. And if the pay is the same or if the pay is more, hey, do what you got to do. Right.
I mean, we very clearly get the collapse. Alex like very clearly says, oh, you're going to do this shit for money. Like you're going to whore yourself out. Like she very explicitly states doing not that guy is terrible. And how could you go with him? No, the act that you are doing is bad and wrong and immoral. Right. And you are selling yourself short. It's like, oh,
versus Alex. Dancing at the other club is art.
Yes. Yes. Which like is an incredibly frustrating in like a movie that could have like taken a step to be like, no, like the sex work isn't the bad part. The shitty owner is the bad part. And like would have fit really well with a lot of the other stuff that's going on in the movie. But it doesn't do that.
But also it's never shitty men, right?
Yes.
It's never the 38-year-old boss that hits on the 18-year-old girl. It's not his fault.
Yep. Uh-huh.
So let's talk about that for a little bit.
So speaking of ways in which this movie has things to say, maybe unintentionally about labor, not only is he 38, he's her boss.
And like, not just he's her boss.
Yeah.
He's her like boss. His name
is on the check.
Yeah, yeah. His name's on the check. So like there is a power dynamic, not just between an 18 year old adult and a 38 year old adult, which hey, is not a crime, but is not usually a relationship that most people are okay with.
Yeah.
If that's your situation, hey, there's a healthy way to do that. Go with God. You know?
Right.
Which is usually how you end up in that situation. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's not for you. Whatever. But there's ways that relationship could work that this movie definitely does not pick one of the ways that I would point to say, this is how one of these could work.
Yeah.
which is...
It doesn't do the worst version of this. It just does a really bad version of this.
Yeah. So, he's 38. He's her boss. He's divorced. They talk through. They do a pillow talk scene where she goes, like, how did you do it? How are you courageous enough to get a divorce? How are you courageous enough to be a successful man?
You man so well. Can you tell me more about your good manning?
And he's like, I just had to one day, I just had to take it. I just had to realize my worth and take the world and be the person that I wanted to be. Which is a great lesson for a girl who wants to do ballet, right?
Right. Right.
There's an American dream story there that could also exist.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that I think the movie is actually very interested in portraying that. And I think that's part of why we get the Genie plot line. And we get, like, this comes up a bunch of times in the movie where you, like, Genie's parents, like, her mom was an ice skater and her dad is kind of an ass.
Yeah, he's kind of a curmudgeon. Yeah. You know, you're going to fail yep. a little bit.
Yeah, and then you find out that, like, the reason he is that way is because her mom was exactly in the same position as Genie and didn't make it. And, right. like, he's like, that was you back when you were her age, and do you remember that? And, like, he gets really wistful. And, like, clearly both of them, like, him and his wife, thought that their lives were going to go differently. They had dreams that for... probably many reasons they were not able to actually see come to fruition. And then Genie has a dream that doesn't come to fruition. And then you have our 38-year-old man, Manon, Nick. He has a dream that he does make come to fruition.
Which it's to work at a steel mill.
Yes. Yes. And to divorce his wife.
And to divorce his wife.
Yeah. But, like, you get all these stories, and there's a scene later on where you have one of the dancers talking about how she was really into acting and drama, and she bought all these elaborate costumes because she really thought that, like, I'm going to make it. And one day she stopped buying the costumes. And she just kept wearing the ones that she had. And then one day, those costumes started to fall apart. And she just kind of put them in a chest and just locked them away. Mm-hmm. She's like, it's funny how that happens. Like, it's kind of like a funny how your dreams just kind of die.
Right.
So, like, the movie is very much, and like, follow your dream.
At one point in time, I think he Nick literally says, if your dreams die, you die.
Yes!
Or something. Yeah.
He does. Yeah.
So... knowing that this fairy tale logic exists.
Yes.
Knowing that we're existing in this dream space.
Yes.
What does it say about, to bring it back to the labor aspect?
Yes.
Of this, what does this movie say about Pittsburgh?
Mm-hmm.
If, since we were talking about this,
mm-hmm.
I think this is a potentially more, again, no one says we at least get some Pittsburgh twang in there. Not a lot of it, but we get some.
And you see the city a lot.
Yeah, you see the city way more.
Actual shots.
She rides the fucking thing that goes up the hill.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, she rides one of those at one point in time, which no one rides those, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah. Now, you know, more people should ride funiculars. That actually is a thing that we should...
Yep.
You know what? Invest in public transportation.
I'm not saying... I'm just saying that, like, I've never
No, you're right.
One.
Yeah, yeah.
Every,
no, absolutely.
Every time I've been to Pittsburgh, I haven't been one. So what does it say about Pittsburgh? What's it say about labor? The Pittsburgh stuff is kind of whatever. It at least is a character. Pittsburgh does have an art scene.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen a ballet in Pittsburgh.
There
actually.
You go.
And it's also close enough to where Heinz is that you can smell fucking ketchup and shit all the time.
Yeah.
it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what's there. I forget. I remember it smelling weird. It's been a long time.
That sounds
time.
Right.
Yeah. So I've been there. I've been to Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is a character in this movie.
Yep.
At least somewhat.
Yep.
So I would give it that.
Oh, yeah. And I don't think I mentioned this. Justice, you have talked about your ties with Pittsburgh. My dad grew up in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
So, like, both of us, you know, I have family that is still there. So, like, both of us are familiar with the city. And so, you know, Not just from the perspective of a fellow Rust Belt city.
I was at PNC Park last year to go see a Pirates game.
There you go.
I was in Pittsburgh because the Toronto punk band Pup did not come to Cleveland, so I went out to Pittsburgh.
That's where I went to see the Bets.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think
we're there.
Yeah.
Like we go there. Yes. We don't know our way around town. We don't know where all the good bars are, but we've been there.
Yes. So I think to that point, though, I think it is clear that, I mean, this is a fairy tale story, and you're getting a fairy tale version of Pittsburgh. And I think part of that is also a fairy tale story about the American experience and the American labor experience. You are not getting conversations about struggles that unions are going through to try to make sure that, you know, steel workers are getting, you know, the hours that they deserve, the pay that they deserve. Like, you're not seeing the workers being like, that Nick guy is an asshole because he's the boss and management doesn't have our back.
She does say that. Like, specifically, one of the reasons she doesn't want to date him is because he asked her out. She's like, you don't date the boss.
Yeah.
You don't do that.
Yes.
And then
she does.
And then her morals immediately get thrown out the window for labor solidarity, whatever.
Yeah. Well, and like the interesting thing is, because this is a fairy tale, instead of like having the workers be like, what are you doing fraternizing with them? They're like,
oh, that's right. They literally applaud after the fight when they reconcile.
Yes. Yeah. So this is very much like an idealized version of what the boss labor relationship could look like, because this is the fairy tale version. You don't get the struggle and the recognition that like management and the workers are not on the same page and are not.
Yeah. Imagine if there was a contract negotiation ongoing while she's fucking her boss, and like, you,
oh my god,
all the other guys or everyone else there working at the mill would be like, no.
Yeah. She would have rats in her gear constantly.
Yep.
Just dead rats.
Yep.
All the time.
All the time.
Yeah. So like, this movie is attempting to get, and like, we see this also with, there's a scene where I think it's the scene where she's walking with Jeannie, where they pass by a cop and they just have like a fun time playing around with the cop.
Oh, right.
Just like dancing with the cop and making funny faces. And the cop is like, oh, you.
And then the cop also, as part of like his thing where he's directing traffic, pretends to shoot someone at the end.
Yeah, her. Like, because she's doing the weird age. Right. She's like, oh, I got you with my gun.
Right.
It's like, ooh.
Yeah.
This is, and hey, in the 80s, turns out that cops having complicated relationships with the public is not new. In the 80s, there was a lot of that going on. So this movie,
I mean, like RoboCop's also a from the 80s,
yes,
right?
Like, absolutely. Like, hey, there were a lot of race riots and race issues happening in the 80s. So like the fact that like the cops were doing that was not necessarily household news, but was not something that people were unfamiliar with or unaware of. So this movie is very much presenting a fairy tale version of that world. This is like America if America were perfect. This is very much the American dream and not the American reality.
The one thing about her getting into the, she's trying to audition for a spot in the Pittsburgh Ballet Conservatory, whatever the fuck it is, just so that she can learn and dance more as part of the Pittsburgh Ballet. And the thing that never really comes up, and I don't know if we ever really talk about it or not, is her race. We get a lot of class.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember in those scenes, like there's a great scene, you and I were just talking about this earlier, where they show all the shoes and it's all the dance shoes and she's in her boots.
Yeah, she showed up to try to fill out the application, and she's been too scared to do it before now because she's like, I'm not going to get in, like they're not going to accept me. So she finally gets up the courage to go to the application office. And you've got this really like uptight secretary who's like explaining how to fill out the application, and it pans to like the other ballerinas who are filling it out, and they are all lily white, like stick thin, like have like clearly very expensive clothes on, and the movie pans down to shoes, and Alex is wearing her work boots. They're covered in mud, messy, big, clunky, and everybody else is wearing expensive high-end ballet slippers or expensive heels.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really good. Yeah. It's a great shot.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's one of the things, like I said, or as I was saying, that they don't really talk about her race as it pertains to her class. It doesn't really come up throughout the entire movie, which I think is almost to a disservice, because I think it's actually, there's something to that part of it also, because this is a pretty diverse, for this fairy tale thing that doesn't have to be diverse. Yep. There's at least, hey, there's some people of color involved.
Yep.
In a way that I almost wouldn't expect with how the rest of the movie goes. That's a surprise to me, actually.
Yeah. The black dancer, all the dancers go to work out together, and they're talking about, like, the one friend is like, he's not going to call. And Alex is like, no, he'll call. And then their black friend is like, man, I'm so glad I don't have to deal with this hunky shit. It's like,
yeah,
it's very funny.
It's very, it's very good. It's very good.
But yeah, she has a diverse group of friends, and like a mostly like blue collar, like,
yep.
And you do like, the one thing that you get, or the one area where I think you get a little glimpse of what you're talking about, but they don't make it super explicit, is that scene where they show the shoes. Because they then yep. pan up to the faces, and everybody is white, blue-eyed, right. blonde-haired, and she's darker-skinned. Not super dark, but darker-skinned, curly, black hair.
Right. Yeah. And the class part of it is great. Like, the movie really hammers that stuff home of... hey, she is disadvantaged. Also, she's from outside of town.
Mm-hmm.
She moved to Pittsburgh. She meets this old, somehow she knows this old woman who,
yeah, a ballet dancer.
A ballet they dancer. Never really... She's a grandma like figure who's, yeah. That part was really hard to understand.
It was hard to understand because it doesn't make sense.
Because it doesn't make any sense. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. I thought
you didn't miss anything.
I thought that was just me.
The movie
and then she dies, and that's the other primary motivator for yep. like Alex to get her shit together and finally go through with the application. And
mm-hmm.
she gets the application because Nick has an in at the board that the auditions are invite only, and Nick knows someone because he's a donor.
Yes. So we need our just like we have our Prince Charming, we need our fairy godmother, which yeah. is that's what the old woman is.
Yep.
And doesn't matter if it makes sense, because she's magic.
But also, Nick's the one who actually does the magic part of yeah. getting her the audition. So, yeah. like, hey, fuck your fairy godmother, I guess. Like, that's the thing that I walked away at the end of the movie with. I did this. What did we learn?
Mm-hmm.
What are the lessons? And Chris, let's do a special segment that we're going to call What Are the Lessons of the Movie Flashdance?
Mm-hmm.
And how effective is it at those lessons? The only lesson that anyone in the movie learns is to fuck rich people. That's that was what I took away from the end state of the movie. Work hard, so,
yeah,
and also put yourself in positions to be successful by pairing with other successful people.
Yeah. So Justice, like a slight addendum there.
Yeah.
So follow your dreams and do that by fucking rich people. That is the lesson
that's,
of the movie.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Correct. That's the lesson that we learned. And never strip. And again, I'm surprised that drugs don't come up. Like, I guess there's only so much runtime.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're alluded to with the Zanzibar stuff, like you mentioned. But yep. you're right; they don't do too much explicit.
Which is weird, because I find that movies that take place in the 80s mm-hmm. that would usually involve cocaine,
mm-hmm.
and we don't see no one, even the sleazy club owner, never alludes to any drugs or anything. And I'm like, this is not true.
He does. I think they like literally he makes a comment about weed.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, like when they're leaving the club one yeah. night, he's like, come hang out with me.
Oh, yeah, let's smoke some weed and watch TV. Or
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. So he makes that explicit comment. And there is, like, when she goes to get Jeannie from the club, there's some comment about substances that is very opaque and doesn't, like, specify weed or coke or...
Yeah.
But, like, you are meant to assume that, well, Jeannie is probably strung out on something.
Yep.
Leave it up to your imagination to figure mm-hmm. out what. Just pick the bad one, yep. and that's probably the one.
Yeah. What other lessons? What lessons am I not thinking of that we learned by watching Flashdance?
Always dance.
Always dance.
Dance is the solution to all of your problems.
I can't believe I missed that one. Yeah.
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 That
always
is
dance.
Maybe the biggest lesson.
Yeah. I mean, she runs. She does that scene where she runs away from Nick, and Nick's out of breath, and she's totally fine.
Yeah.
You know why? Because she dances.
That's right. That's right. I will say, like, I I think the movie does do a good job of like making it believable that she is in stupidly good shape because she is constantly working out or at the steel mill. And you're like, yeah, you could probably break me in half as a human.
Right. And she's very small. Yes. Like she's very tiny while also like, but they show some of that is not healthy tiny either. Yeah. She's like, well, we didn't eat today or we didn't eat yesterday. That's why we're eating a lot today because we didn't eat yesterday. And they kind of don't comment on that.
Another opportunity where they could have like made some of the like class and money stuff more explicit, but
it's just kind of there. Or she's like, I don't eat lunch, but it was like, is she avoiding the date? But then we also see a scene where she doesn't eat.
Yeah.
So it's like, I guess
both maybe
a lot of mixed messages.
Yeah, it's true.
I don't know if I have too much else from Flashdance. If you do. I mean, I could talk about the soundtrack for 8 more hours.
Yeah, it is a really, really good soundtrack. It's really, really good. And I do appreciate how, like, I think the soundtrack, because in the soundtrack, we do actually get references to her as, like, being a steel girl. Like, there's the soundtrack is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that very much is pushing the themes that we're talking about in a way that the movie, in some cases, is not.
Again, for a movie about music and dance, there are scenes where part of the story is told as like characters expressing themselves through dance.
Mm-hmm.
There are multiple times where she's like challenged to communicate. And the only thing she can do is dance.
Yeah.
Right. And that's kind of neat.
Yeah.
The one that they do towards the end again, which is like, hey, epilepsy warning, there are going to be a bunch of strobe lights in your face for like a solid minute and a half.
Yeah.
Where I couldn't tell, and that was like right after an emotional scene.
Yep.
Again, I couldn't watch it because it was too many bright lights, but I think she was trying to express, the movie was trying to have her express something about like being a working woman and the traditional aspect, like the costuming is like the shoulder pad.
Yeah.
So there's something there.
Yeah.
But I couldn't actually have my eyes turned towards the screen because it gave me a headache.
I think a lot of the dance scenes do a good job of that, but that's one of them that doesn't work as well as I think they thought it did.
What I mean is like characters dance to express themselves.
Yeah.
And I think the part where the movie does that is only semi-effective because the ones that work.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And the ones that do not work, you cannot even look at. So like that's all the only point I was trying to get to is like, even where it's doing, hey, here's art and here's what art is and what art can give you as an individual, right? It allows you to express yourself in a way that words can't.
Yeah.
Even it fucks that up. Just not every time, but eventually it's like, shit. Okay.
I do also want to, we talked about this a little bit before recording. So I do also really love the scene when her and Jeannie are walking and they run into the breakdancers.
Oh yeah.
And you get to see, so they stop and they watch and you end up realizing that they just stop and watch basically for like half the day. And like, it's not just, so initially there are two breakdancers, there's a white guy and a black kid who are really talented and really good. And they're like, this is, and so they stop to watch. And then some more people show up and then some more dancers show up. And eventually, like, it seems like you've got like a bunch of folks from the neighborhood who are just hanging out, kind of like cheering the dancers on, having a nice time, having what is very clearly like a nice time together. And like, it's a really nice way of illustrating how dance has brought these folks together. And how, like, the difference between the, like, very stodgy, very, like, you see the ballet scenes when she's at the conservatory and, like, trying to, like, everybody is separated, everything is regimented, like, there is no community, it feels very hierarchical, it feels very, like,
clinical?
Yes, yeah. Exactly what I was looking for. It feels very clinical. And then you get this scene where, like, it feels like, oh no, dance is like a way to express these feelings and emotions and to get people together and to make people feel something beyond just like being collapsed in on themselves. And I think that does a really nice job of doing some of that, like, hey, dance is an effective form of communication. And you have a little bit of the blue collar dance versus like fancy white collar dance. Mm-hmm. And like what happens when the dance is like maybe commodified and looked at as, well, this isn't something for the people. This is something to be like given to rich folks, for rich folks to consume. And what's the difference when you do something that is for the people? And how does that actually land?
Right. But if you follow your dreams, you can also be a thing that only rich people can consume. Right?
Yeah. Don't think about the message
too much. You can also take the type of dancing that you learn from the street and apply that to only rich white people.
Yeah, this is definitely an area. And like now I'm kind of like, man, if only we had watched Breakin' as a companion piece to this.
Sure.
Because one of the things that Breakin' does is it kind of like it actually tackles this like divide and says, hey, no, the problem is that the ballet is too stodgy and does not accept these other forms. So let's force them to see the value in that dance. And like there's some discussion about like whether or not that is the right way to do it, too. But like that movie is actually like grappling with that question in a way that this movie is just like, ah, she did it.
She did it.
She's a ballerina now.
Yep. She did it. I think that's everything for Flashdance.
I think you are correct.
All right. Bonus round. I got a couple for you.
Okay.
You're vegan.
Yes.
So what sandwiches do you put French fries on now?
I mean, you can now a vegan Philly is a pretty common thing. So like you can throw some French fries on that. You can do like vegan, like Mr. Hero hoagie style stuff too.
Yeah.
We've got the vegan meatballs. Throw some fries on that. Yeah. We have options now.
Yeah. And vegan pierogies, we know those are a solved problem.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
Absolutely.
I see beer, yes. Iron City, or Yuengling.
Ooh.
Which one do you think is more Pittsburgh-y, Pennsylvania-y to you? And also, if you had to pick one to drink right now, I don't have them. but if you had to pick one to drink that you were like, oh, I'd have one of those.
I mean, Icy is the right answer here.
Yeah.
Icy is definitely the right answer. And I don't know that I'd have a good time drinking the Icy.
Yeah.
But it's been so long since I've had one. I've had a Yuengling way more recently.
Yeah.
But I feel like Yuengling is like the more mediocre, less offensive of those two, which is not to say that Yuengling is bad.
Yeah. I have taken a tour of the Yuengling facility.
Hmm.
It's fine.
Yeah.
I like Yuengling a lot. I would take a Yuengling over an Iron City. Depends on the catch me at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And they now make icy lights that are like flavored icy lights. It's like the whole thing with like Budweiser. So like
sure.
Yeah. So it's all like, hey, the icy light brand is one brand and Iron City beer is a different brand and whatever.
Hmm.
So yeah, I think I would take me personally. I would take a Yuengling.
Hmm.
And that'll do it for us at Cultural Fugazi. Thank you, everyone, for listening. You can email us, us@fugazipod.com. Let me know what you think of the city of Pittsburgh. I don't know.
Yeah.
Where have Chris and I not been in Pittsburgh? And then him and I can plan a road trip.
So, oh, that's a great, yes.
Yeah.
Tell us that.
Tell us that, and we'll do that.
Yeah. And I do love that Pittsburgh and Cleveland, two cities that have remarkable art scenes because steel and oil money. Just,
you know, at some point in time, maybe we'll do like the Cleveland based episode of like things that are kind of about Cleveland, but not really. There's plenty of movies that are that.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we'll do that another time.
Yeah.
For next week, I think we're going to, or next 2 weeks, next episode, I think we're going to try to read some books. Specifically, I have a book in mind about steel unions and some of the steel union movements of the 1950s. I'm not going to pull up the name of that. You'll know it whenever we talk about it, because you're not going to read it.
It's Fight Like Hell, isn't it?
No, that's the one about, that's the other one. That's the women's labor book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which I think that's probably going to be the two that we read.
Gotcha. Yeah. So I suggested No Shortcuts, which is not specifically about Pittsburgh, but is about labor.
Yep.
So labor history. I think We've alluded in the past to some of the ways in which unions got kind of corporatized right around the Clinton era, and this book gives us a lot of that context.
Excellent.
So, yeah, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And then if we fuck that up, then we'll just watch some movies and you'll find out whenever we do.
Yeah, it'll be great.
We'll see you next time.